Welcome back to Hash Straight Up. Today is all about Stronghold Digital. I had the great pleasure of sitting down with the CEO, Greg Beard. We talked about the company, its profile, vertical integration, and a lot more. Hash Straight Up starts now. Enjoy. All right, everybody. Welcome back to Hash Straight Up. Thanks for tuning in once more. Today, I have the great pleasure of speaking to Mr. Greg Beard. Hello, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We are at Blockhead 847795. Hash rate on the 14 days, 596 exahashes, and the hash price is still $56 per petahash. It hasn't changed because the last two recordings I did this week as well. Greg, welcome. Thanks for taking the time. I don't have Stronghold on the list yet. I'm glad I can add you guys today. Excited to speak to you and to learn from you. We want to focus the conversation a little bit about around vertical integration, and would love to hear what your stance is on that and how you guys are achieving that. Before we get into that, though, can you give yourself a brief introduction, just 30 seconds on your person and how you even got into Bitcoin in the first place?
Oh, a great question. Well, happy to be here. Thanks for having Stronghold. I'm the CEO of Stronghold Digital Mining, which is a vertically integrated Bitcoin miner, which means we own our power assets, data centers, and the machines. That's the vertical integration part. My background is really as an energy private equity investor. So I spent 10 years running the Apollo Energy business, 10 years at Riverstone before that, and started in the early 90s in the energy group at Goldman Sachs. So this is, I really view Bitcoin as a, you know, an energy arbitrage. And I got into business really through a friend of mine that owned one of Stronghold's two power plants. And we figured out together that the best use for the plants and the land is to set up a Bitcoin mining data center, which is what we've done.
How did you convince suit and tie energy guys to jump into the Bitcoin game? Because I've had the same question. I asked the same question to Nazar, who's also an infrastructure energy guy. And it strikes me as confusing why that happens in America, but not so much elsewhere.
So I'm not sure that we did. I think so. We were the first Bitcoin miner to go public the regular way through the SEC, like not through a SPAC, you know, not through a merger. So, and it was, you know, it was a difficult process to get through the SEC. We had done two private rounds of financing before going public, and there were some, you know, a few institutional investor, like suit and tie investors in the private rounds. And I think what they were seeing was like really the beginning of the institutional interest in Bitcoin, because we'd seen, you know, we went public October 2021. Bitcoin is, you know, that was within weeks of Bitcoin hitting the previous, you know, all-time high. And so I think we had really good timing to access the private capital markets and public capital markets. And I think it was probably just the, you know, a bit of, you know, what turned out to be bubble type pricing for some of these IPOs and, you know, DSPAC transactions.
You said Stronghold started with two of their own power plants. So you basically went from being an energy business into being an energy and Bitcoin mining business, or only Bitcoin mining now?
No, so now the way we think about it, and the energy asset is unique. So I do want to describe how we make the power, but the benefit of our model is that if power prices are super high, we can shut the data center off and sell power to the grid. And I think last year we did that a few hundred times. So this is not a maybe it'll happen sort of situation. We can very quickly, meaning within seconds, scale the power utilization of the data center back and divert all of that power to the grid if power pricing justifies it. Alternatively, if power prices are so cheap that it doesn't make sense to make the power, if the cost to buy power is cheaper than the cost to make it, we'll turn the plant off, which occasionally we do. And I would say we like more and more, I think for the next few years, we're expecting to do that seasonally. At one of our plants, and because the cost of making power there is slightly higher than the other, And one of our plants is cheap enough that it's unlikely that we'll even shut it off seasonally. So it's really I think if you looked at most Bitcoin miners, if the price of power spikes, they can always shut their data center off. But we have another turn on the option by being able to sell the power that we generate, or to, you know, curtail the miner. So it's a multi-way option instead of just a one-way option to mine or not.
Just to understand this better, Greg, is the all-in power cost or the all-in cost to produce the kilowatt hour higher than the revenue that you get from your machines? And if no, why does it make sense to ever turn the power off?
Yeah, so our cost to make the power at Panther Creek, which is our eastern Pennsylvania plant, is just under $30 a megawatt. And depending on which machine you're talking about, you know, if you plugged in a, you know, state-of-the-art brand new, you know, S21, for example, you tell me, what would we get per megawatt? Something probably 12. Over, you know, 150 per megawatt. So that's a fantastic, you know, margin on a new machine given our cheap cost of power. But if you're running an old, you know, S17 machine, that's not going to make, in a per megawatt basis as much, right? So you probably break even on the old machines. In Western Pennsylvania, our cost of power is mid 40s per megawatt. And so, in that instance, hey, all of our machines are economic, even at mid 40s, but we're able to buy the power in Western PA right now for, you know, under $30 a megawatt. So it just makes sense to buy it instead of make it, which is what we're doing.
And you said the power generation asset was unique.
You want it to talk is about unique. It? Yeah, so sure. So we are really a reclamation business. I think the history of Stronghold, I was anticipating the question, and in one way it started on the IPO date, you know, for the public Bitcoin mining investors. But for Pennsylvanians, the Stronghold story really started with the advent of coal mining in Pennsylvania. So the coal mining has been happening in Pennsylvania for a few hundred years, but before the mid 1970s, it was allowable, it was legal to take the bad quality, the low BTU or low energy content coal, and just leave it on the surface, out in the open air, and that left a few billion tons of this waste on the surface, scattered around about 800 different sites across Pennsylvania, which, you know, is sort of tied with West Virginia as like the, you know, the highest rate of cancer in the country. It's Pennsylvania, West Virginia. I think it's related to all of these, you know, coal piles and the pollution that they put in the air and in the water. So Pennsylvania incentivizes us to partner with the, you know, local bodies to clean up the mess, to clean up these waste piles that have been left behind. And we gather them up with, you know, bulldozers, excavators, and haul them by truck to one of our two sites, one of our two plants. And the plants are unique. These are not coal. These are not thermal coal plants. They have specialized boilers that were designed to combust this very low BTU, low energy content waste. And we do that with the purpose of reclaiming the lands and stopping the pollution. That pollution is, you know, like it pollutes 700 miles of streams across Pennsylvania. It maybe 80 of the 800 piles are on fire right now as we're recording here. And not to mention, like, these aren't, when I say pile, think like mountain side. It is not these aren't like a pile of leaves sort of piles. These are giant, you know, hundreds of acre sites where you can't have vegetation, where it's the equivalent of car battery acid ending up in the waste water that runoff. The rivers run red because of this stuff. So, like, in my view, it's a little bit, it's, I'm upset that our federal government let it happen and then didn't really prioritize the cleanup, because this is the coal. These are the communities that, that mine the coal that built New York City, where I'm sitting right now, or Chicago, Philadelphia, and really fueled our industrial revolution here. The coal mines are largely gone, but the waste, you know, and the wreckage to the neighborhoods and the communities is ongoing. So the state incentivizes us to clean these piles up. We get paid a payment per ton that we reclaim. And then we also get renewable energy credits, which is the same as like what solar and wind and hydro would get, rather. And that incentivizes us to clean up this problem. So I really view it as we're a reclamation business, where the byproduct of that is power, and we use the power to make Bitcoin, because that's the best market for it, that power.
Just to understand this better, I think I read about this before as well in an article somewhere. Are the Bitcoin mines set up next to these piles of dirt as well? And because otherwise there would be no other demand for it? Or is it the extra incentive that the government in this case gives you guys that makes it worthwhile picking it up?
No, so you can't. So our plants would cost about $500 million each to replace. So you can't set up shop next to one of these waste sites and like quickly and easily build a plant to use that waste. And we have to, you know, we'll haul it, up to like 40 miles right now, plus to get it to our site. And these are, you know, it's a 10 story giant building. If you're ever in, you know, next time you're in the US, come and see it. They are giant operations. And it's a really sophisticated technology that lets this waste combust. It's almost more akin to a chemical reaction than it is a burn. And it's, you know, we put in crushed limestone, and the resulting ash that comes out the back end of the plant is deemed to be a beneficial use ash. That's non-toxic, which is very different than what would come out of a thermal coal plant. We have emissions controls that remove, you know, 99.something% of all of the cancer causing toxic emissions that are ending up in the air when they're left unattended to, and you know, when they burn, obviously.
But again, just to further dig down, because it's really interesting, before Bitcoin mining, why could you not produce power with that stuff for 24/7?
Oh, we did. Yeah, we did. We did.
You did. Okay.
Yeah. So I think the first 2 decades of the plants, they were on fixed price, fixed power price contracts to make the power out of the waste and sell it. And I think in more recent years, we are merchant plants, meaning we sell power into the grid at the merchant price plus the renewable energy credit that we earn on top of that.
All right. What was the main reason, Greg, for you guys to go public? Why did you decide to do
access
that?
To capital? So I think I'm proud to be an American, and I would say, you know, hey, while we definitely have our issues, one of the best things we have is access to capital markets. And hey, I'm proud of the stronghold model, where we can, you know, buy the power, make the power, you know, make the Bitcoin or curtail. That's a unique strategy, even in mining. And I think the public market liked the story, and we got access to capital from the public markets in doing that. And I think as I'm sure you've heard from others, hey, it's a setting up data centers, getting access to the power, that these are capital intensive projects. When you do industrial scale,
was there any specific project that you raised public money for, where you said, "Hey, like we want to do this, but we need capex, so let's go public"?
Yeah, so both to build out the data centers and buy the miners for both plants. That was really the described to be, and some plant and rehabilitation was also described as sort of the use of that capital.
When you present the company, the tagline is we're a vertically integrated Bitcoin miner. Why is vertical integration such a focus point for you guys?
Yeah, I think what's really becoming apparent, I would say in the past year, I guess even just to back up, for most of the big Bitcoin miners that are public today, they got the majority of their growth to date during a time when power was cheap and readily available, you know, across the U.S. It's like right now, Texas is the biggest site for mining. And that's really a result of Texas having had access to very cheap power related to cheap gas. That has changed now. So now PJM, the grid where I'm operating, is expecting cheaper power pricing for the next few years. And if you looked at where current prices are, if you were to enter into a PPA to buy power, it's at least double where it was just a few years ago. So I think what was apparent to us with the model of vertical integration was one, to create this multiple way option to buy power, sell power, and have the ability to make more margin during times when power prices are super expensive or super cheap. When I think about the grid in the U.S., I really describe it as like the Californication of the grid, meaning we're adding more solar and wind, which are intermittent sources. And the effect of that is we're making power prices generally higher than where they used to be and a lot more volatile. So if it's a sunny, windy day in Texas, expect power prices to be, you know, free or even negative. But if it's, you know, if it's cloudy and still, you might have power prices and 100 plus degrees, which it is for, you know, 90 plus days, you might expect to have, you know, triple digit power pricing to go along with the triple digit temperatures. So,
before you go further, Greg, why do you say, sorry to interrupt you, why do you say it gets more expensive? Because I was on the same discussion, one of the last few interviews that I had. Why do you say more renewables make power more expensive?
Well, I think for one thing, if you were just to study, which I've done, every grid around the world, around the U.S. as well, the higher the percentage you are of renewable energy, the more expensive the power prices are and the more volatile they are. And the reason for that is because renewable energy, like solar and wind, they're intermittent, that they're not baseload producers. So you need to have that, you want to have that green infrastructure in place, but you still also need that baseload power capability. So you're really doubling your generation capacity and not really getting to eliminate the old baseload. So it's not a, that's one factor. The other is we have a little bit of a little bit of a misleading, you know, statistics on is solar really cheap? And I think my favorite example to describe why I think it's not as cheap as it has been described is if you were to take a 100 megawatt, you know, gas fired baseload plant, that'll run around the clock 24 hours a day. If you wanted to replace that with a solar plant, you'd say, well, hey, just put a 100 megawatt solar field in. And the issue is on the sunniest, you know, at noon on the sunniest, longest day of the year, yeah, that plant will make 100 megawatts. But on average for the year, it'll make only 18% of the 100 or 18 megawatts. And on the darkest day of winter, it'll make 10 megawatts. So it's not really a 100 megawatt nameplate solar field does not really replace a 100 megawatt gas baseload gas plant. Further, to get them to be, well, what would it take to make them apples to apples, to make the solar power around the clock, you need a gigawatt or 1,000 megawatt solar field is what you would need to have to then power a battery to make it a baseload plant year round. And that you're now talking about, well, hey, so to install 1,000 gigawatt solar field with a coupled to a battery, we're talking about 20 times more expensive than what a gas plant would be of the same size. And so I think the misunderstanding is we're talking, if you're talking nameplate gas capacity versus nameplate solar capacity, that's where people misunderstand, hey, what's the real cost? Because if you're going to get the same performance, you have to make it 20 times the size.
What role do you think subsidies and financial incentives to build out these renewable capacity or this renewable capacity play? Because
they wouldn't happen if it didn't have the subsidy. So, I'm a realist. It's happening. In fact, if you looked at the development of solar in the U.S., we're gonna have a record year. I think it's more than 50 gigawatts of solar plus batteries. It might even be as much as 80 gigawatts of solar plus batteries is expected to be installed in 2024. And I don't think we would have much if it weren't for the Inflation Reduction Act and all the incentives that we put in place to do it. I think if you looked at, with the risk of sort of being canceled, if you looked at what our biggest economic competitor is China, they're building 25 nuclear plants right now and have dozens and dozens more that are, under consideration or being proposed and planned. We turned on our last nuclear plant in the U.S. just a few months ago, and hey, it had massive cost overruns. I think it's like it's just an unfortunate reality. Hey, we'll probably wake up, hopefully next year or next week, but certainly in the next few decades, we'll say, what have we done? We installed all this super expensive intermittent power, and meanwhile, our economic rival has round the clock cheap baseload power by installing all these nukes.
Look, Greg, I don't think there's any risk of being canceled here. I'm a German national myself, and I studied energy economics in Germany. We turned off all of our nuclear research. Power prices are at 40 cents, and everybody celebrates Germany for a great renewable energy transition. And you're like, hey, if you give me unlimited amount of cash, I can make any transition a success, right? We don't have much of a disagreement here at all. Let's get back to vertical integration. That's where I interrupted you. Sorry.
Yeah. So in my view, just the advantage of owning the power asset, which wasn't apparent, I'd say AI, which I'm sure, maybe it's been talked about on your show, the power intensity of AI is between 6 and 10 times of a regular, say, Google search. And if you looked at power demand in the U.S. and globally, AI is a factor. Like it's being talked about. We need in the next 5 years, something north of 50 gigawatts of new power just to satisfy AI related data centers. I guess bringing that back to vertical integration, hey, if power demand wasn't going to grow and power were readily available and cheap, yeah, then spend your money and your time just on running your data centers and buying new machines. But I think what's become apparent really in the past year is that power isn't going to stay cheap, and it's really difficult to develop new power assets, particularly in the, with the not in my backyard movement. Like getting new pipelines, new transmission lines, new plants built, it's really, really hard. And you can't solve the power needs of a data center with solar and wind. You want to have baseload power for that. So we had a power crisis before the AI demand came along. And we have an old grid. We have an aging grid that needs tens of billions of dollars of rehabilitation just to sort of keep it going. We're seeing an increasing number of blackouts in California, now in Texas. It's related in part to aging infrastructure. So we had difficulty before we had this increased demand. So we had flat demand for like 15 years. And now we have a really rapidly increasing demand related to AI data centers, and being vertically integrated lets us control our destiny with regard to getting access to cheap power. And then if power doesn't stay cheap, we'll get the benefit of being able to sell it into the grid And so it lets us have this multi-way option that as we see more volatile pricing is going to become more apparent how important that is.
Are you going to vertically integrate further down the stack as well? You own infrastructure. You don't need to own transmission, I assume. You own your ASICs. Obviously, you own your own sites. Are you thinking about your own pool, your own firmware, all of that stuff as well as you think further down the value chain?
You know what? We own our own transmission line, and that gives us, you know, sort of additional optionality. Mm-hmm. When I think about like what's next for Stronghold, it's probably not to own our own pool. I think there are, you know, technologists that can provide that type of service and charge a fee that'll be better for us economically than developing our own. I think which is going to be different than most miners, is that when we see our sites, we own 600 acres at one site, 150 acres at another site. We have access to a lot more power than what we're currently consuming, what we're producing. And so the question is, hey, I think our next development site is probably right at home. You know, I think we're looking at ways to expand our power consumption, and then really determining, is the best use of that power Bitcoin mining, or is it better HPC, or better to, you know, partner with a developer for making an AI related data center site. So it's I guess it's the further benefit of this vertical integration, owning the land, having access to a lot of power, having access to fiber. Like, those are the ingredients that give you a lot more potential optionality and potential value. So that's really where we're focused more on that, on those ideas, rather than on hiring, you know, programmers to build out more efficient systems.
Yeah, and as more money flows into, you know, capital markets and gets allocated to Bitcoin mining companies, I'm with you. I would estimate, as a absolute layman on this, just having conversations, that those miners with access to infrastructure and that flexibility will be able to attract more capital, which of course then enables you to build out more sites and more capacity, right?
That's right. But I think it's a race. I mean, if you think about who the Bitcoin miners have mostly had unfettered access to power without competition from many others. So now we're competing with the best capitalized companies in the world, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Amazon, and they are in a race with each other to capture sort of the AI market. And I don't know, I wouldn't want to compete with them. I'd rather benefit from their competition, because I think, and I'm sure they're thinking, hey, in 5 years, this race will be over. There'll be winners. We'll see. You're not going to have four winners in AI. You might have two. And they want to capture that market. Getting access to this power is essential to them. They can't win without the access to power. So I think I like our position.
Greg, how many megawatts do you guys consume today?
So we have two data centers, and each one consumes about 65 megawatts, so 130 megawatts of consumption today.
Okay. Do you see, on the AI topic, I'm split, right? Either there's sort of this Bitcoin mining camp that says, hey, AI is going to come in, all these tier 3, tier 4 data centers are going to compete for the same exact power, and it's going to push Bitcoin mining out to the fringes. After one of my last few interviews, I'm sort of more in the middle and towards leaning towards the other camp, where I'm saying, hey, there is not enough power structure or infrastructure, to your point, available today, right? And for AI to utilize the existing power infrastructure, they need to be able to curtail their consumption, and they can't, right? So they need to add Bitcoin mining to their portfolio to add that flexibility in demand response to their sites, because they have to have 99.999% uptime for all these other services that they are trying to offer to the market.
Yeah, I'm of the view that we're competing more than collaborating on the sites, because I think the Bitcoin miners have the benefit and advantage of being able to curtail, as you point out. And that makes us great partners for like solar and wind. But it doesn't, it's not really needed for baseload consumption or baseload supply. And I would say the big data centers, they need, you know, backup power on top of their baseload supply. And that's going to really promote probably power purchase agreements with gas plants and existing nuclear plants, because I know they want to be carbon free if they can. But I'm not sure. Like I think if I'm to think about, hey, who's going to win? How's this going to happen? I think what, if you looked at the amount of like thermal coal plant shutdowns in the past few years, we've shut down like 20 gigawatts of thermal coal, which was baseload power. We're now saying we're going to shut down another, call it 10 in the next couple of years. We really haven't added any new gas plants of material size in the past few years, but we're adding all this solar, which really isn't appropriate baseload for data centers. So we're compounding the problem by shutting down baseload without adding baseload to replace it. And that kind of worked if you could do batteries in scale with it. And, you know, we had a little bit of excess power before that, you know, you always want to be able to make more than what you've got. And, you know, like an 80% rule, you know, have generation capacity that's so 20-30% more than what might be used, just to have a safety measure there. But I think we're kind of through that. So I think if anything, what's likely to happen is that plants that were expected to be shut down aren't going to be shut down. You know, I think nuclear plants that are sort of at the end of their nuclear license, expect those to be extended. You know, coal plants that were supposed to shut down last year or this year, expect them to stay around longer. Because you can't, like, someone's going to, like, the system's going to break. You can't shut down all this base load. Say you're replacing it with an intermittent source that doesn't provide baseload power, and not build anything new and add all this demand. So I think the system has I would say my headline is somebody's wrong. Either we're not shutting it down, we're building a lot more new stuff, or we're going to not be building as much AI as what we thought. And I think they're just going to compete like mad for the existing available sites.
Yeah, no, I had a DPO on as well. And the way I kind of see this going, because adding batteries to all of these power plants is just going to drive price up, just like financial incentives will, that at the end the consumer has to pay for, right? Yeah. We've got a lot of old machines in the US right now that are being cycled out, and all of those would be potential fits to increase consumption nearby solar plants, giving them that revenue source that, you know, would maybe come in part from financial subsidies. But I recently went to the German parliament and talked about Bitcoin mining, and in that country power prices are like at $0.40, and there's no more room to financially incentivize, you know, where's power price going to go? 50? Industry is already moving away. Like, you cannot put more subsidies into those electricity prices. It's just not possible. So maybe I'm obviously conflicted because I breathe this industry every day, and I sort of see everything orange. But it's a very logical conclusion to me that all of these older machines that are in the US today that cannot move because, you know, they don't want to be sold for $2 per T right now, they'll end up on all of these stranded assets where somebody says, hey, we can deal with 50% uptime, 60% uptime, whatever, and we'll do it like DPO, giving, you know, the generator a floor to their electricity price.
I agree that it makes sense. If whenever you have, you know, super cheap prices, to the extent the infrastructure is already built and you can put a data center or even like a shipping container with miners in it. Sure. Like, I agree. That is a natural use for that excess energy.
Let's shift gears a little bit, Greg. I wanted to speak to you with regards to vertical integration, also about treasury management. And I want to understand a bit better how public companies typically manage that today. How do you guys approach treasury management? Is this something you outsource as well, or do you do all of that in-house?
No, we manage it in-house. We like right now we sell the BTC that we mine, you know, probably every few weeks to every month, just depending on what's happening in the market. And we're doing that because we need the cash to pay bills and have CapEx to buy new machines. But I think, hey, the goal is clearly, to the extent that you generate more BTC than what your CapEx needs are, the goal is obviously to start hodling as much as you can, just given that we're believers in Bitcoin, the value of Bitcoin, and we know that our investors are as well. So that's an aspiration that we'd have. But today we end up converting our BTC to cash to spend that capital.
And how do you think about the sort of obligations that you have against or towards, what's the right word there? I'm not sure. When it comes to shareholders, like, how much do you need to sort of allocate to paying out dividends regularly? And is that maybe a disadvantage to a private miner that can sort of...
We don't pay dividends, and I don't know of any public miners that do. So we spend, which I think there are some interesting business models that might someday, you know, come around where people do pay sort of BTC style dividends. I think a company that did that could be valued at a premium, I believe. But I think a way to answer that question right now is you look at what's the best way to allocate CapEx. And interestingly, right now, if you looked at the cost of machines versus hash price, the return on that machine right now is relatively fast. So you can buy a state-of-the-art machine and you'll have probably less than a 2-year payback, depending on your cost of power on that machine. I think there have been times when things have been a little bit more frothy in the space and you had as much as a 4-year payback on machines. And so I think right now it's a cycle, but we're at the point in the cycle where it's a good time to invest. The returns are good when you invest new capital now. I think looking backward, it turns out we invested and a lot of others invested at a time that turned out it was a bad time to invest. Even though Bitcoin price was high, hash price was high, the return on those investments didn't pan out as much as we would have hoped they would have.
How do you come to a decision like this? I mean, if I look at the ASIC price index of Luxor right now, right, it's very hard for me not to get extreme FOMO and buy all the ASICs that I can. As a private miner, again, I can just go out and do that. What's the process like there for you guys? If you look at this, how long does it take you to actually execute on an idea like that?
Yeah, so from our vantage point, we do the same thing that you just described. You look at, hey, where do ASICs trade? Should you buy, the state-of-the-art brand new one, you know, that's the most efficient, or should you, buy one of the older, less efficient machines at a dramatically lower price? I think the answer to that is, hey, what's the cost of your power? So if you have a super cheap power price, or power were free, don't spend the CapEx. Get the older machine that's less efficient, and you'll have an astronomical rate of return on that machine. If your cost of power is higher, or if you're trying to show or you have a limited amount of power, then you're better off buying the more efficient machine, even if it costs you more money, even though the payback will be longer. So I think the difference right now, what's going on is everyone, meaning the public market, has these astronomical projections for what growth rates will be. And I'm not sure that they have, and I think they have access to the miners. I think Bitmain will make the machines that are needed to achieve that. I think the question is, will the plugs be there and will the power be available? And will those that with those projections be able to deliver their growth, which power and this and sites are required to do? I don't know. I think it's got a lot in the past year. It got a lot harder.
Have you guys ever considered hash rate derivatives and selling hash rate forward to maybe fund an expansion or something like that? Or would you always go via the public funding
route? No, we have. I think, and we look at it. So I have a financial background. Everyone on my team on the executive side, we're all sort of financially trained people. And I think on that market, in my view, is an implied cost of capital that's still in the teens. And so I think, hey, when that will become much more interesting when the implied cost of that capital is single digit. So yeah, we look at it and study it. And I think we're probably as an industry all more optimistic as well on where Bitcoin price might go. And so sort of, you know, locking in potential upside for a teens cost of capital seems like it's a tough idea to do so far for us.
How does that improve?
You know, I think just as the ecosystem gets bigger, you know, there'll be a, you know, when capital is competing to get access to the, you know, the other side of the trade, then the cost of that capital ought to get less expensive.
The analogy that I have here is a small pool trying to grow, right? If you have an idea like this, how do you grow that idea if everybody's sort of at the, let's just wait until it's bigger, right? If everybody's leaning back, nobody's gonna make that move.
I think what we need is we need a well-capitalized investor that's willing to say, hey, I want to own this market and create a new market and go in and be willing to take, you know, evaluate the risk of that sort of hash trade and decide that it's a single digit rate of return worthy investment. Okay. And but to date, I think most of those that are in that business are trying to earn, you know, at least double digit and probably 30-40% rate of return, because they're probably levering on top of that. So I think we just need more, you know, you get institutional capital that has a different lens of risk return, and that will quickly change the market. Maybe with the ETF capital coming in, that can happen.
Yeah, I agree with you. If I did further play devil's advocate, I would say, like, somewhat the Bitcoin industry as a whole, this includes Bitcoin mining and all the investments around it, is kind of constrained, because everybody that invests money in this sort of industry understands Bitcoin. And so now any investment idea has to compete with Bitcoin expected rate of returns, right? Otherwise you're losing out. So this kind of stifles innovation to an extent, perhaps, where everybody expect Bitcoin purchasing power to increase dramatically in fiat terms, and therefore doesn't really feel like it's necessary to invest.
Yeah, that seems like that's what's happening, right? So I think you're correct.
Greg, we are running short on time. Let me squeeze the ASIC question here as well. The oldest machine that you guys are running today, the least efficient machine, what is that?
I think we probably have still a few M30s, MicroBT M30s. That's probably and then we have some Minerva machines that are sort of equivalent to an M30.
Running. What are you guys doing with those?
Yeah, as we upgrade, so like, hey, right now we're considering sort of a big, you know, site-wide upgrade where we would unplug, you know, literally thousands and thousands of machines, which is something that we're always looking at the math of, should we upgrade? We think there's still a market for the older, less efficient machines. And I think it would sell them through, you know, probably one of a handful of machine brokers that we have bought from.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think, and we've also looked at recycling for the, you know, if there end up being no market, you can end up recycling the machine as well.
Would you go the global diversification route and seek out lower power and higher risk jurisdictions? I don't know, talking about Paraguay, maybe below 3 cents, 80% uptime, or, you know, Ethiopia is very common right now.
I think you always have to look, but I think, as I alluded to, like, our next growth sites are our current sites. You know, we have access to a lot more power with what should be pretty modest investments. And that's easier. And I still think, hey, with all of its flaws, the U.S. is still a great place to do business, where, you know, with a few exceptions, rule of law is still functioning here. So, I'm interested in other countries, and obviously a fan of cheap power. I think you have to look, but I think you do that if the alternatives, more local are exhausted.
Understood. Greg, is there anything that I did not ask you that you wish I had?
You know what? I think, hey, we covered a lot, and I appreciate you, you taking the time to get to know Stronghold a little bit. I think, that's it. Thank you.
Last question. Do you think that Bitcoin consumes enough electricity or not?
I'm a free markets, advocate and supporter. So the electricity that Bitcoin consumes is exactly the right amount. Meaning, hey, if Bitcoin consumes more, it's a competitive market, it should. And if it consumes less, it's the right answer. So I think it's, my hope is that our regulators, our global regulators, let free markets decide who gets to use power. Let free markets decide who gets to build new plants. Free markets decide who shuts down which plants. So I think the answer to your question is, in a free market system, which is what we currently have, those that are willing to pay the most for the power get to use it. And, for that reason, it's like, hey, whatever we're using as an industry is the right amount.
It's a very diplomatic answer. Greg, thank you so much for your time. I definitely learned a lot about Stronghold. I hope my audience did as well. Guys, if you have comments, questions, please visit their website. They are very responsive. This was a very easy interview for me to set up. So thanks again also to the team that's currently in the audience. Guys, if you learned something new, you know what to do. We'll talk mining again next Sunday. I'll see you there. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.